You are listening to New World Order, episode 371. This is Plateau. In this episode, we're going to talk about LXC. Why? Because we're going through every single binary installed on the Slackware operating system, or distribution, as the case may be. If you're not running Slackware, that's fine. You can probably still get quite a lot out of this, because these applications that I'm talking about are probably available on your distribution. You can use apt or DNF or whatever it is you're using to install software, and you can follow along with most of this, if not all of it. And hey, if you're not running Linux, then stick around anyway, because you can learn stuff about Linux and some of the applications available for Linux. And quite frankly, they may be available on your operating system for Homebrew for Mac or Chocolatey for Windows, so check those out. And I mean, hey, it's all open source anyway, so at the very least, you can go get the source code and compile it yourself if you really wanted to. Well, LXC is a little bit more complex than that, though. Get into that. We'll talk about that, and if you're not running it, that's fine. You'll still get a lot of valuable information about containers. That's a hot topic these days, isn't it? So let's talk a little bit first about some listener feedback. Yes, Bill, I don't know if I'm supposed to use the last name, so I'll just call him Bill. He emailed me weeks ago now and said, hey, I've got some episodes from your show, from the New World Order, that seem to be missing from your archives. Would you like a copy? And my first reaction, obviously, was, what kind of scam is this? Turns out it was not a scam. I have downloaded the episodes that are missing. I haven't uploaded them yet. I have downloaded them. I have scanned them for any kind of insidious virus or secret message. I cannot find anything. So I think Bill is for real. I think he actually just happened to have some episodes that I was missing from my archive and decided to offer them up to me, and he sent them to me. And gosh, wasn't that nice? So I will be adding some shows to the archive that were missing. So if you're doing the whole listening back through the archives and you've experienced some shows that are not there, or you've found some shows that some shows aren't there, well, they will be restored shortly. So thank you to Bill for that. Bill also sent me a really cool email afterwards, after all of the episodes have been sent and downloaded. He sent me a cool email afterwards talking about his sort of history with Linux. And it's quite a long email, so I'm not going to read it all. But I'm going to touch some highlights here. So first of all, in 1990, this is Bill speaking, in 1990 I got to play with a Tandy business class computer that had Xenix, that's X-E-N-I-X, OS on it, and with 8-inch hard drive and floppy drive. I was fascinated with creating multiple user accounts and with file permissions, being able to create a user, a group, and world, and set world permissions on the directories and files. So that was the first thing that kind of caught my eye, because I'd heard of Xenix. This is class 2 again, sorry. I'd heard of Xenix, but I didn't know a whole lot about it, so I kind of quickly did some research on it. Didn't find all that much, but it's definitely an interesting one. It's from 1980, not open source, so it is a Unix, though, and it was developed by, believe it or not, Microsoft, and SCO, that's S-C-O. So this was a Unix based, licensed by Microsoft from AT&T, apparently, and acquired later on, I guess, by SCO, because SCO got, like, all kinds of Unix intellectual properties, as we probably all know. And if you don't know, then not that long ago, like, within my Linux-using experience, SCO, S-C-O, was suing everyone left and right, claiming that they were the only company or whatever with rights to anything Unix-related, and they were quite fierce about it. It was pretty disappointing. They were, the common term for it is patent troll. So they developed this Xenix thing, this port of Unix for apparently like personal computers. Like it was available on the desktop, and it was Xenix. And apparently they said in 1981 that Microsoft, this is a quote, Microsoft hopes that Xenix will become the preferred choice for software production and exchange. And Microsoft referred to its own MS-DOS as its single-user, single-tasking operating system and advised customers who wanted multi-user or multitasking support to buy Xenix, essentially, instead. So really, really fascinating stuff, a history that I had no idea about. Some of you probably will have memory of this from real life experience, but I was not, this is news to me. I did not know about this. So fascinating history. If you're really interested in it, just all I did was go to Wikipedia, but then they of course link to a bunch of places from Wikipedia, including Byte Magazine and various places. So if you want more information, just do yourself a favor, go read up about it on Wikipedia. I would go on and on and on, but frankly that wouldn't do any good because I'd just be reading stuff from Wikipedia and passing on, you know, the secondhand information. So it would be, it's probably better that you just go read that yourself. Okay, so then in 1998, says Bill, this is Bill again, in 1998, or at least 1999, I bought Red Hat at a Circuit City store. If not Circuit City, then CompUSA. I was able to install it, but no drivers for my graphics card were available, and I found myself at the prompt with nothing to do. I played with it from time to time. So this is Class 2 again. That's a great, great memory. 98, 99, whatever. Yes, you could walk into a computer store. First of all, there were computer stores back then. Or rather, there were dedicated computer stores that sold software on the shelf. They were like disks in a box, and you would buy the box and you would take them home, and the disk would go into your computer, and that's how you got software back then. You didn't download it, you purchased it. You purchased physical copies, different time then. This was 98, 99. So you went into this store called Circuit City, which having grown up in America, I have definite memories of Circuit City. It was that they were a sort of a big well, a big box store, I guess, is what you kind of more or less call it. But it was a big store, and it did a lot of consumer electronics. But if you were in a town without anything better, they might be sort of your place to go for, like, computers and anything technical. It was, like, the worst place to go. It was a step up from Radio Shack, which, again, in America is kind of like almost the bottom of the barrel. Circuit City, or at least was when I was there. Circuit City, step up from that, they were, their big red building is what they were. They were a big red storefront, if I recall correctly. And their commercials on TV always had this little animation of like a plug being plugged into the wall, but then the plug would become a Circuit City store. It was pretty fancy. But, I mean, if you went there, inevitably you would find that the cables were five times as expensive as they should have been, and their computer selection was lacking, and their software was lacking. But anyway, back in 98, 99, maybe it was different, I don't know, but stores like this literally had like Red Hat Linux on their shelves. And I remember this personally as Quack 2. I remember this because I went into a computer store in New York at the time, and I remember seeing on the shelves Red Hat Linux, Yellow Dog Linux, and OpenSUSE, or SUSE, I guess is what it would have been at the time. And I think I've told this story before, but yeah, I didn't know what those were, but it seemed to me like it was all very colorful, right? Because it was Red Hat, Yellow Dog, and SUSE, which was, if I recall correctly, in a green box. I could be making that up based on more recent memories, but it felt strange to see them. I didn't understand what it was. I looked at the box, or someone explained to me that it was Linux and it was an exciting new operating system. I didn't even know what an operating system was at the time. All I knew was that it was they were themes. This obviously is incorrect because Yellow Dog is the exception here, but as far as I knew, they were themes that you ran on PCs. And PCs, to me at the time, meant not Apple. And I had been mostly brought up to think that Apple was the only correct way to do computing, and therefore anything not Apple was to be avoided. And so I avoided that for a very long time, and got kind of annoyed at people who would try to tell me that it was worth looking at, because I thought, well, that's stupid. It's a PC, and I don't use PCs, so I have no interest in this Linux thing whatsoever. So that was canonically My first experience with Linux was as a stupid kid in a computer store who thought that it was just some kind of weird, office suite for PCs, boring stuff. So that was how I first encountered Linux, sadly. And I often think, oh man, if I'd only known, if I'd only gotten started back then, how different would it have been? And you know, to be fair, I don't know how different it would have been, because at the time I was not interested in computing. I probably would have failed miserably, much like Bill here did. I mean, well, he doesn't say he failed miserably, but he does say that he ended up at a prompt with nothing to do, and I feel like that's probably what would happen to me. So, so he went through some other stuff. He tried various things. He ended up at some point on Mandrake. He settled on Mandrake, loved it, thought it was so easy to install, it looked great, loved KDE 3.5, which I could customize to look just the way I wanted it. And I've certainly said this on this show before, and I'll probably say it again in the future. Mandrake, for people who don't remember, or for people who weren't around at the time, Mandrake was a big freaking deal. It was like the Ubuntu of its time. It was the Linux that people could purchase and use and actually get support for. I mean, it was a game changer, Mandrake was. And I never used Mandrake, so I'm kind of going off of stories here, but that's my impression, is that it was a big game changer. And when I first got into Linux, Mandriva, the Mandrake, and I'm blanking on the name, the two distributions kind of merged and became Mandriva, and they created Mandriva. And Mandriva was really great. I mean, it was genuinely a very, very cool project. And Connectiva, that was the other distribution, Connectiva Linux. It became a really, really nice Linux distribution with a very cool program where you could purchase sort of like their star program. I don't remember what it was. And you would get these power packs full of more software than their free repositories contained, and it was, you know, it was a business model. It was something that you could try and you could do and maybe get support for. And I don't know, it felt like a very great idea, but I think what we've all learned since the early 2000s is that just the model of computing has moved on from live support, and that's difficult for people to grasp even the concept of why would you expect live support for a computer product. But back a long time ago, and I'm watching the Netflix series High Score. If you're not watching that, you might be interested in it. It's about video games, and it's a pretty good, pretty neat series. It's talking about all the popular video games, and it kind of goes through the very beginning of video games back in the, I guess, 80s, and then kind of through the slump that occurred, and then the revival of the video game market with Nintendo, and then the transition into Sega, or the addition of Sega, and so on. But one thing that you get from that is that there used to be people that you could call on a phone for support for software, and you could do that for all kinds of things, whether it was your office suite or your video game, and you could call the software publishers, and you could talk to people. Sometimes you could talk to the developer. That was a big deal. No, it wasn't a big deal, and now that would be a huge deal. And for whatever reason, whether it's just because that model doesn't scale, or I don't know, but that's just not the model that I think that's fallen away. That's not something that we can sustain, apparently, because nobody does it anymore. So you can't really do that anymore. But I think that Mandriva certainly gave that sort of that feeling, that model a try, and sort of the inspiration from all that of just saying, okay, well, if you give us some money, we'll make sure that this repository here, which you'll have permission to access if you pay a subscription fee for, is updated with even more stuff or even later stuff. And you know, the anti-capitalist in me says, well, I don't really love that model, but the realist in me says, well, maybe that's not such a horrible idea. And certainly I've had subscriptions to, for instance, Red Hat before, and you can get a subscription to Red Hat, but they are obviously very, or not obviously, but they tend to be very server focused. So even if you have a subscription, you're not gonna, for instance, call them up and say, hey, I need KDE Live to be installed on Red Hat. in an easier way. And for the record, that is actually pretty easy. You just install it by Flatpak. But some other thing that you need maybe, and that you're not going to find someone there who knows how to do that probably. So yeah, I just unfortunately the computer industry is kind of has developed in such a way that the idea of support just doesn't seem to be a realistic business model, and that's where we are today. And then Bill talks a little bit more about other things, and it's all very, very interesting, but it does go on for a bit, so I don't want to hold up too much. The final thing that he does mention that kind of made me think about was that he loved playing with DSL, which was a very tiny Linux distribution. He mentions Tiny Core specifically as well. And that kind of made me think about how I don't really get to mess around with portable distributions so much anymore. I mean, I've definitely done that before, and it was great. And I've done episodes both, I think, here on my show and on Hacker Public Radio about it. And it's so cool that these small portable Linux distributions exist, and I think it's more than cool, it's kind of really important. But as someone who, when you start settling into a place and you're not moving around all that much, the portable Linux thing becomes less important, less significant, because I really don't need it so much anymore. I mean, I still carry, but my keys aren't on me right now, actually. I still carry Porteus, a Slackware-based small distro, on my keychain. It's on a little metal thumb drive, and it's just great, but I don't use it much anymore because all my computers have an OS on them, and I'm perfectly happy just using the OS that's on them. And it's just kind of one of those things that it starts to fall by the wayside because you just don't need it as much anymore because you're not moving around like you used to. And especially right now during pandemic times, you just really don't have a chance to go up to random computers and pop in a portable distro and reboot and use Linux on them. So, maybe sometime in the future I'll be doing that again. But yes, I do kind of miss it, to be honest. I do miss that portable experience. But at the same time, it just doesn't make sense for me right now. Okay, so let's talk about LXC. LXC stands for, I actually don't know what it stands for. Linux Container Project is what it stands for. I don't know what the X part stands for. Maybe that's the X at the end of Linux. But if you go to linuxcontainers.org, you find the LXC project there. You'll also find the LXD and the LXCFS. But we're talking about LXC, which is it's a set of tools, templates, libraries, and language bindings. Low level, flexible, covers just about every container feature supported by the upstream kernel. LXC is production ready. This is all from the linuxcontainers.org site. Production ready with LTS releases, coming with 5 years of security and bug fix updates. That's LXC. LXD is something different. It is it's quote unquote the new LXC experience. It offers a completely fresh and intuitive user experience with single command line tool to manage your containers. Containers can be managed over the network in a transparent way through REST API. It works with large scale deployments by integrating with cloud platforms like OpenNebula and OpenStack. And finally, there is LXCFS, which is the user space that is Fuse, F-U-S-E, file system, offering two things, probably more than that, but two big ones are the overlay files for CPU info, MIM info, stat and uptime, and then C group FS compatible tree allowing unprivileged writes, which you kind of learn more about if you start using tools like Podman and things like that. So that's LXC, linuxcontainers.org. And what all this has to do with really anything is that containers are a really, really big deal. And, people can say that and talk about it and go on and on about it all they want. If you're not using it, you don't quite understand what that means. So I'm going to kind of try to give you a perspective on it. It is a perspective. So Linux containers, starting from sort of the very basics, we've talked about this a little bit before with namespaces, specific and share, unshare. We NS Inter was a command that we talked about in a previous episode. So we've had some exposure to this on GNU World Order before. I don't believe I've gone over LXC during that time. If I have, hopefully this will be a slightly different spin on it. But for LXC, or rather for Linux containers, we should kind of walk it all the way back to virtualization, right? And there was big deal virtualization was from about, I'm just going to use the dates of my awareness, which doesn't really cover it, but let's just say from like 2003 or 2004 or so, all the way to like maybe, I don't know, 4 years ago or 5 years ago, so 2014, so maybe a good 10 years, there became this, well, let's put it this way, virtualization really came into its own. And that's an important way of saying it, I guess, because virtualization has kind of been around for a lot longer in one way or another. And I think if we're broad enough, we could just look back as far as, you know, the mid-80s or so, or maybe longer, who knows, where, you know, there were emulators and things like that. And that's not virtualization, that's emulation. That's why I say if we're broad enough in that concept. But eventually, like, people, you know, the computer industry was kind of dancing around this, and you'd see it all over the place. You'd see it pop up here and there, such that my memories of it was, if you absolutely need to run some PC application on Mac, here is a software that will make that happen for you. And lots of different companies flirted in that space with varying degrees of success. And then finally, someone came out with a virtualization thing where the big deal was, hey, look, stop messing around with compatibility layers and emulators and things like that. Just install the operating system you need. It will pop up in a window on your operating system, on your current operating system, and you have a window into a different operating system. And then you can run whatever you need to in that window. And that's what we'll do. That'll be the thing that we do. It's a virtual machine. It's a virtual machine. And that was okay with everyone. I personally was excited about the technology, but a little bit disappointed by sort of a lot of aspects of it, right? It just doesn't really feel like that's the most graceful way to accomplish this goal of making things cross-platform. So to me, I didn't love virtualization, didn't hate it, didn't love it. But once I found out about Linux, then it became a lot more appealing to me, because now I felt, well, now I can try Linux without having to install it first. Or once I was have switched over to Linux, I can run other distributions of Linux without having to install them, and so on. So it was a useful tool. But again, I don't know that it was ever anything that was terribly sort of realistic as a solution for anything. Although that said, I mean, at one particular job long ago, my avenue to running Linux at that job was to run it in a virtual machine. So, and I would actually use Linux on that virtual machine. Like, that is actually what I would use, which was cool. You know, that was useful. So it's a useful thing, and it became so useful that systems administrators started using it in earnest, to the point that they would buy, let's say, 4 hardware servers, like 4 actual physical servers, bare metal servers. They were actual things, and they would put them in a rack, and they would put them in a room that was air conditioned and power controlled and everything. That's what they would have, right? But on those 4 boxes, they would be running 4 virtual machines on each box, and one virtual machine would manage all of their email, traffic, and another virtual machine would handle all of the web server stuff that they would need for the intranet, and then another virtual machine would handle all the web traffic for the internet, and so on, right? So you'd have like these virtual machines with rather dedicated tasks or some subset of tasks, and you'd have failovers and all sorts of things. And it was quite powerful, because maybe before you would have had to buy 16 servers, but now you only had to buy 4, and they were powerful enough to run 4 virtual servers on the inside of them, for, you know, within virtual machines. That was a big deal. And I mean, it was such a big deal that companies built an entire business model around that. I mean, it was legitimately, I mean, it was the service that some companies provided, and that lasted for about 10 years. And luckily, I kind of dodged that bullet altogether. Like, I didn't really ever have to go down the virtualization path all that seriously. I did use a couple of virtual machines here and there, but I never really had to invest too much time or energy into it, which, looking back, I think I'm happy about. I kept meaning to get more into it at the time. I never did, and looking back, I'm kind of happy, because it's kind of like, nobody does virtualization anymore. I mean, you do on your desktop for fun, but not in the professional, sort of, the actual, you know, sysadmin world. I mean, I'm making a huge generalization here, but I think everyone in the industry would agree that that is not the way things are moving now towards virtualization. And instead, things are going towards containers. And so the difference there is that when you create a virtual machine, you are creating a, let's call it a container. You're making a box, right? And you're saying, okay, in this box, I have a motherboard, and I have a network card, and I have a CPU, and I have some memory, and then I've got the OS on top of that, and the OS, I have all the user stuff. And that's a virtual machine, because it starts with that, the basics, the motherboard inside of a pretend metal case. Well, when you build a container, you don't have to do all of that. You say, well, I don't need a metal case, because I've got a metal case right here on the computer. And then you say, well, I don't even need that motherboard, actually, because I've got a motherboard right here on my computer. And I don't need the memory, and I don't need a CPU, and I don't need any of these things, because I've got all that stuff running. And in fact, I don't even need a driver for the graphics, because I've got that, too. So there's all these parts that, because you have it on your actual physical computer, you don't have to account for it in your definition of what your quote-unquote virtual machine, or specifically your container, you don't have to account for that in the definition of that container. You can just say, just pass through. Now, the stuff that you want to be different within your container, that you do have to account for. You have to say, well, I need this set of libraries, because that it's my pretend computer would need those libraries in order to run the software that I want to eventually run. And you might think, well, why wouldn't you just pass that through? Well, you could do that, but then then there would be no container. You would just be running software on your computer. So the presumption is that you have some software that you want to run, but you want to run it in such a way that it is completely isolated from the rest of your box. So you give this container thing just the parts that are different. It's kind of like the delta of your computer. And so it's an extremely, especially compared to a virtual machine, it's quite a lightweight entity within your computer, within your physical box that is running. Now, compared to, for instance, just downloading some source code, compiling it, and running it, it's a lot more, it's considerably more bloated, right? Because it's got the software, but then it's got all those libraries that it needs. It's got everything that when you type in LDD, everything that it connects to, that's what you have to put into your container. And if this is sounding at all familiar to you, you might think of things like app images or Flatpak or even Snap. You could arguably say that they're related to containers, to container technology. This is all kind of in a related space. And it is definitely, it's probably maybe not in the same family tree as virtual machines, but I don't know, arguably you could probably even say it was in the same family tree. Because, you know, as virtual machines kind of, as that technology developed, we started seeing progressive ideas like hypervisors. I wanted to say hypervision, hypervisor technology, where you could tell your virtual machine, hey, you know what, don't worry about the CPU, or rather do worry about the CPU, but then you trick it and you tell it that its CPU is, you almost simlink your CPU to your virtual CPU. It's maybe a good way to describe it. And that was a big deal, because now you didn't have to have a CPU driving a fake CPU. You could just point the fake CPU to your actual CPU, and suddenly your virtual machine is running off of the same, you're running off of the same calculations directly. So it's all kind of related, this sort of semi-transparency technique from the space that you are trying to create virtually and your actual physical computer host. But Containers has managed to do that with just a whole different level of sophistication than virtual machines ever could. And part of this is because containers are Linux. There's a t-shirt with that phrase on it that I wear quite frequently. And people have asked me before, what does it mean, containers are Linux? And it is simply a truism of containers that when we say containers, when we're talking about containers in the sysadmin world, that's Linux. A container, the container that you are creating is Linux. And that's kind of an important thing to remember or to be aware of, because if someone says, well, do you know containers? Then in one sense, you, dear listener, whoever you are, whatever your experience, if you are running a Linux right now on your computer, then you have like a huge amount, like some percentage of knowledge about containers that you don't even know you have. Because once you may not know how to spin up a container, you may not know how to get into a container, but once you figure that out, you are exactly where you want to be with Linux, because that container is running Linux. So if you know how to run a computer with Linux on it, you know how to run, as it were, a container. Now there's a bunch of subtleties about containers that you may not be prepared for, but the container itself, you will find very comforting. You will be at home within that container. There's no question about that, because the container is Linux. And yes, you can run containers on a Windows host, but like for instance, Docker, which I've done a Hacker Public Radio episode on, you can go hunt that down if you want to. That was in the early days of Docker, relatively early. You can run it on Windows, but I mean, once you're doing that through this abstraction layer that was Docker, that is Docker, I guess, the container that you spawn is Linux. And so you've got all the information you need to deal with that container. And a lot of people, I don't think, quite realize that. Like, a lot of people don't understand how big of a deal that is for you to already know everything about the internals of that container, because you already know Linux. That's a huge, huge advantage. And so if you are someone looking to maybe branch out into sysadmin stuff, or you're looking to branch out into computer stuff, just understand that containers are Linux. And if you are a Linux user, you've got a whole set of experience that a lot of people dealing with containers, they don't have that. Because they're running it off of a Mac host or a Windows host, and they don't know what to do once they're inside of that container, or once they're talking to that container. Big deal, really. Don't underestimate that. Don't undersell yourself on that point. Okay, so before we get into LXC usage, let's go take a coffee break. And we're back. You've got coffee. I hope. I've been sipping on my coffee, so I've actually already had it, but I waited patiently for you to get one. You're welcome. Let's get started with on really using LXC. There's not actually that much to say about it, but I think it's worth a quick tutorial, I think. So the first thing that you have to do is create a network bridge, and you can think of a network bridge as, for instance, a Y adapter. When you're, you know, if you've got two people who want to listen to some audio on a computer, you can plug in a physical Y adapter, and it gives you two inputs instead of one, or two headphone jacks instead of one, or even a power strip. If you've ever used a power strip out of your electrical socket, plug that in, now you've got more. Same kind of deal. Same signal, but it's getting routed a couple of different ways. I guess you could think of it as that. There's probably a subtlety there that I'm skimming over that's not fair, but you get the idea, right? It's a bridge. It's going to bridge some signals. So the way that you do that is, I guess, really a two-step process. You do this is with the IP command, and you could do in Slackware either sudo, possibly, it kind of depends on how you have sudo set up, what the path is. So you might want to just do su and then put in your password as root, and then as a root user, IP space link space add. So you're adding a link, and we'll call this br0, this bridge zero, type bridge. BR zero is, of course, arbitrary. You can call it anything. You could call it bridge. You could call it penguin. It doesn't matter. BR zero is the more, that's the typical name for that you would probably want to use. That would be highly, highly expected by any other sysadmin. So that's probably what you would want to use. Once that is created by you, then you can do an IP show, no, IP adder show, I guess. So ADBR show and then BR0. And this is telling me that BR0 is, it exists, it has a link, and it's got some properties. So it's a thing. It exists, essentially. And that's good. So you can just do IP adder show, and it'll show you all of your network interfaces, your loopback, your Ethernet, your wireless, whatever. But interestingly, if you do, for instance, an ifconfig, then you'll notice that the only internet or the only interfaces you see, network interfaces you see, are ETH, in my case, ETH0, loopback, and WLAN. No BR0. Well, that's weird. Okay, so the reason for that is because this hasn't been brought up yet. You can do that by doing an IP link set BR0 up. That brings this bridge up, and then if you do ifconfig again, then you see BR0, Ethernet, loopback, and WLAN, or whatever your interfaces are. But the point is that it'll actually be, it's an active link now, as opposed to just existing. I think that's more or less all you need for this as root. So, and this, understand that LXC is a low-level it's a low-level interface for containers. This is not how you would normally probably be creating a container. There are other ways to do this now, and more than likely you'll be doing containers on some kind of cloud, on a cluster somewhere, and so you would be using an application front end for container management, such as Podman, Kubernetes, or Docker. Like, more than likely you're going to be using some combination of those technologies. You're not going to actually be using LXC locally on your own computer. But this is still an interesting way to kind of get a feel for what a container is. It gets you into like the low level side of container creation. And that kind of makes sense. I think it helps other things make more sense. It makes Podman or Docker, for instance, make a little bit more sense when you're throwing these containers into existence. How are they, what's making a container? Well, they are, but with LXC, you are. And that's what we'll do next, is create a container configuration file. And understand, to in many ways, a container, it kind of is just a configuration. I mean, it's not entirely, but a lot of it is just a configuration file. Like, that's your virtual machine. It's a text file describing attributes, okay? So you can open up an empty text file in your favorite text editor, call it mycontainer.conf, and you have to give it a couple of, like, sort of just a few really basic attributes. So lxc.utsname equals, and give it some name. So we'll call it New World Order Container, or you could call it mycontainer. Let's call it mycontainer. Okay. lxc.utsname equals mycontainer. lxc.network.type equals, in this case, you would probably do a veth. So that's a VETH, virtual Ethernet, VETH, V as in Victor. lxc.network.flags equals up. That's kind of self-explanatory. I think we want this thing to be brought up on creation. lxc.network.link, you could probably figure out what that's going to be without me telling you, but you'd have to think about it maybe, equals BR0. Remember, we created that bridge. Well, now we want to tie this container to that bridge. We want to make sure that we're getting that container signal through the bridge. And then you have to make some stuff up. So, for instance, the lxc.network.hw adder, that's the hardware address of your network. Your pretend network card, which doesn't actually exist. So you can make up some fake MAC address for your pretend virtual Ethernet card. lxc.network.ipv4, you need to tell it what network you want your container to be attached to. And Again, that kind of depends, but you could say 192.168 dot, I don't know, 168.1/24. It's a pretty good subnet. And then LX, and I'm doing 192.168.168.1/24 because I don't know what subnets you actually have in use, and I feel that's a pretty safe one. You would want to ensure that you're not forcing any kind of network collision with your choice of subnet, but I would leave that up to you. Certainly, if you know better, then you can do something different. But otherwise, just set it to like 192.168.168.1/24. It gives you lots of address space. It's quite safe. LXC.network.IPv6 equals, and then make up a IPv6 address. And that's all you kind of need. There are more options which you can view by looking at a sample LXC configuration file, which I think it's in USR. Okay, well, actually, you can do manlxc.container.conf. That would be a good place to start as well. But then there's another. The actual examples are in USR share doc LXC dash version number blah slash examples, and you see quite a few different example container configurations there. You can look through those and get a feel for what kind of properties you're allowed to specify within the container. Now, keep in mind also, I'm talking about LXC-2.0-9, and Linux containers LXC right now says that it's on. Does it give me a version number quickly? No, it doesn't really. Well, it's 3.0, certainly. LXC 2.0 is supported until June 1st, 2021. LXC 3.0 supported until June 1st, 2023. So there you go. So I am speaking about one that arguably is out of date, although not technically because it's still supported until 2021, so we're okay. Okay, so at this point you're almost done. You're about two-thirds of the way finished. You're an operable container. You have your network infrastructure because you created a bridge, and you've got some properties of your eventual container defined. But now you need like the OS. You need that base layer of a container, which really is just the OS, because you've got your computer, right? We've said before, you've got your physical computer that's going to run your container. You just need a better definition of what that container is exactly. Now, luckily, LXC comes with a bunch of stuff for you already defined. That is in /usr/share/lxc/templates. And in that container, or in that template folder, you find definitions like LXC-Alpine, LXC-Alt-Linux, LXC-Arch-Linux, LXC-Busybox. I'll start skipping some. LXC-CentOS, Debian, OpenMandriva, that's interesting. OpenSUSE, Slackware, sounds familiar. SSHD, Ubuntu, and Ubuntu Cloud. So quite a few little templates already defined for us, which essentially, I mean, that's the OS part of the container that we want to use. So the way that we can do that, because those are templates, we have the infrastructure already in existence for Slackware. So we're going to use the Slackware template, and we'll do an lxc-create --name-my-slackware-template-slackware. And once I hit return, it immediately starts downloading packages required, the bare minimum package set required to spin up a running but separate Slackware instance within a place called /var/lib/probably lxc. I don't know. I don't remember off the top of my head. But and it lists these packages as well, and it tells you exactly what it's getting: /aaa_base, /aaa_elflibs, /aaa_terminfo, /bin/bzip2, /core/utils/cyrus/sassel, /db40, and it just goes on and on and on. A lot of these things you'll recognize from previous GNU World Order episodes. I mean, a lot of these are the basic ones that we talked about in the A package set, and it downloads all that stuff. It's funny, I think in this case, I would almost think if I were clever, I would probably create a method by which I could just tell it, hey, don't go grab it from the internet, just grab it from over here. You know, I would just have all those files in a place where you could just grab it very, very quickly. And certainly if I was doing this on a regular basis, that's exactly what I would do. So it's doing that right now. It's downloading a bunch of things and it's creating a root file system in, let's find out where this is. Yeah, it's /lib/lxc/slackware/rootfs. That's creating the root of the container. And you see, it's really quite interesting to watch it. You see Slack package actually installing stuff. Like you see it installing, you know, just as you would with your own, if you were installing something on Slackware, you see it fly by and installing these packages. So once we're done and it is finished now, I would do lxc-start --name, what is it, my Slackware, -rcfile./mycontainer.com, and that starts the container. Now, we haven't attached to it, we haven't quote-unquote gone into the container, we've simply started it. If we want to go into the container, we would do lxc-attach --name/mycontainer, and then we would, it returns a prompt, and you might not even realize that you've been transported anywhere. But if you do, for instance, an IP add or show, you'll see that suddenly you only have two interfaces, loopback and Ethernet something or another. And your IP address isn't what you would think. It is INET IP 192.168.168.1/24. Well, maybe that is what you would think. But if you were expecting to see the IP address of your host machine, you know, the physical computer, you might be surprised because, yeah, you're not there. That's not where you are. You are within this container. This gets really confusing because, for instance, if I do an ls right now, I see the files that I would expect to see, like on my host computer. So this, and in fact, if I do a host name, I get my normal host name. And yet, if I do that IP add or show, it's obvious that I'm not really in my host computer. I'm somewhere else. I'm at some other IP address. It can be very confusing because that the layer of separation between the container and your host OS sometimes is not as drastic as you might expect. And to get out of that container, to unattach from that container, you would do an exit, and then you're back on your host. How can you tell? Well, easiest way, I guess, is IP add or show, and you'll see now that you've got your loopback, your Ethernet, your WLAN, thank goodness, your bridge zero is back, your virtual Ethernet is back, or there is a virtual Ethernet card now, and so on. So it can be disorienting because it just doesn't feel like, for instance, a virtual machine where you go into this virtual environment and everything's different. In fact, unsettlingly, everything appears to be the same except certain aspects of your computer. And that's because of that whole namespace concept, this idea that the kernel itself, the Linux kernel, the thing driving your computer, can set up these walls, these partitions, and just imagine that there's a computer over here running. But it's not a virtual machine. Even the word container is probably a little bit confusing, because a container, you do kind of think of it as a container that you put things into, and it becomes its own thing, right? It's a box. You can pick it up, you can carry it around. And as I describe it, I'm realizing why they chose container, because that is actually everything that I've just said is a very apt description of the ability that this gives us. But really, it's less a container than maybe a roped off section, you know, like a boxing ring or a crime scene. You know, it's kind of like this really sort of really rudimentary, like, okay, well, everything in this square is my Slackware, not Slackware. And so if you're in that square, then you exist there and you don't go outside of it. Well, except when you want to come outside of it, just duck under the tape. It's not a big deal. We're fine. Because it's just namespace. That's all it is. It's namespaces that define certain processes, or that bind certain processes to specific resources. And that's what a container is. It is a namespace. And that is why those things like NSInter and unshare and things like that. That's why those commands exist, so to ostensibly to help you. Not that I would ever actually mess around with this, but you could if you wanted to. If you knew what you were doing, you could go in there and kind of mess around with those namespaces and define new namespaces and so on. And again, go back to the GNU World Order episode in which I speak about that. You'll learn more about it. Whether or not it'll actually be of use to you is a completely different question, because it's pretty low level stuff. And like I say, LXC itself, in a way, is pretty low level, and I think there's an argument that you're probably not going to really use LXC directly yourself all that often. Then again, maybe you will. It really kind of depends on, a bunch of sort of the solutions that are being used, because it really does just kind of, it depends on your environment. I've not used LXC in the real world for like a big deployment. Everything in my actual real life experience has been with Podman. So that's the Podman is kind of the daemonless dropping replacement for Docker. When Docker was still a thing, people were, still a thing, but I feel like it was kind of a force for a while. It was sort of this big tank that was rumbling around being not very open. And then they sort of got bought up by someone, and the remains of it sort of is just like this open source daemon and specification for a specific kind of configuration file, which is not the same as an LXC configuration file. I quite like the LXC configuration file compared to a Docker file, but it's a different purpose, really. So LXC, it's good to know about. It's good to play around with. It's powerful to get you kind of introduced to containers. I do sense that it can be a powerful thing on its own. I'm just saying that in real life, I have not had a chance to deploy it anywhere. But it's great to know about, great to have a go with. So if you want to get your feet wet with containers, take a look at LXC. It's on your computer right now. Pretty, I think relatively, honestly, it's pretty darn easy to use. Although I think arguably so is Podman. So I don't know. Take your pick. Point being, just getting kind of familiar with how containers come about, how they're created, and how they're started and stopped, and how you attach to them, and how you can interact with them, because it is, like I say, the container analogy, it's good, but it's also misleading, because you're not going to step into that container and then live inside that container. You get to peek into that container or reach into the container and do stuff, but you don't go into it the way that you would a virtual machine where you had to click on the window and then your mouse is captured inside of that window and there's a desktop. That's not the container experience. Containers are different, but they're powerful, and people are using them all over the place for development and for running services, all that stuff. So you do want to get to know them. You want to get familiar with them if you want to kind of go farther down the computer science path, because it's a big deal. People are using them. Okay, that's probably it for this episode. But gosh, you know what? We're one letter away from being done, or we're one package away from being done with the L section. And it's so darn tempting. In fact, you know what? Let's do it. Let's just do it real quick. It's going to be quick. It is LZIP. LZIP is it's a zip tool that you might think would be related to, like, zip files. As far as I can tell, it is not related to zip files. That seems odd, but actually, you know what? We'll test how related it is in a moment. But LZIP it's a zip tool. It uses LISMA lossless data compression, and it works more or less how you would think. So let's do an LZIP. What do I got? Well, I got this mycontainer.conf, for instance. So I'm going to just do LZIP mycontainer.conf. And if I do an LS, then I find that there is a new file here called mycontainer. No, not a new file. Sorry. The file mycontainer.conf has been turned into mycontainer.conf.lz. So it's been LISMA'd. If we do LZIP dash dash decompress, or just dash D if you prefer, decompress mycontainer.conf.lz, do an LS, now it is no longer LISMA'd. It is now just a normal uncompressed file. So that's cool. Okay, so what we'll do now is we'll do LZIP on this other file that I have here called trashy.git. And it's a folder, it's a directory. LZIP trashy.git, not a regular file. Can't can't do what I want it to do. Oops. Okay, so we know this. We know this because we've probably experienced this problem when we've tried to gzip a directory or bzip a directory. Can't do it. You have to turn it into a tar file first. Okay, so tar create --create --file, or just CF for short, create file trashy.git.tar, trashy.git. Okay, that worked. And now we'll do an lzip on trashy.git.tar, and indeed, we have now an lzipped version of that of that directory. Cool. So now if we do a, let's do a disk used, du-h on trashy.git, says that it's using 1 megabyte. We probably shouldn't do the human readable. It's doing, oh, it still says 1024. Okay, so it's using apparently exactly 1024 megabytes of, wait, did I say 1 megabyte? Or I did. Okay, 1 megabyte. So 1024 kilobytes of space. 1 megabyte. Let's do an ls-lh on the Lismud version of it. It is saying it's only using 145 kilobytes of space. So that's a pretty big decrease there. Let's compare it to something that we're kind of used to. We'll do a tar cf for create file, trashy.git.tar again, trashy.git as our source, and then we're just doing a gzip of trashy.git.tar, and now we'll do an ls-l. So the gzip version of it, actually we'll do lh, gzipped version is 163 kilobytes, and the lzipped version is 145. So we're saving a good 20 kilobytes from gzip to lzip. Of course, we owe it to ourselves to do the tar command again, and do the bzip2 command again, or rather, now, bzip2, and do an ls-lh, and we get 156 on bzip, 163 on gzip, and still 145 on lzip. So in this scenario, lzip has improved the bzip2 results by about 11 kilobytes. Yeah, and in a previous test that I'd done, it did not outperform bzip. It came in larger than the bzip on lzip. So I think the results are going to vary. I think it's going to kind of depend on what you are compressing. A couple of interesting options here. There is the, obviously, --decompress to undo what you've just done. There is the --recompress or --F, and that forces recompression of compressed files. So if we do lzip-F or --recompress of trashy.git.tar.bz2 and then do an ls-lh again, we get a file that's 158 kilobytes for our bzip2 recompressed as an lzip. So not exactly an improvement on either bzip or lzip, because remember it was 156 previously. So I'm not exactly sure what the recompress does, but again, different tests render different results. So, and this is like one random one that I randomly chose, so don't hold me to these results necessarily, but it is kind of, it's an interesting idea anyway, and I think it would probably be worth maybe playing around with, although to be fair, maybe not. This is the kind of thing where I feel like once I find a mostly good compression, I tend to just stick with that and leave it at that, because I figure, I don't know, I don't quibble over, I don't know, a couple of hundred kilobytes or even a couple of megabytes typically, not when compressing. That said, you know, there are cases where you do need to do that because you're trying to frantically fit some file on some medium that doesn't have, you know, that's just 300 kilobytes short or something like that. So maybe that would be something to explore. And I don't know, there are a couple of other things like the compression level, --0 through -9, that sort of thing. --fast gives you a --0, --best gives you a -9. Again, not really something I ever have to worry about. I'm never that pressed for time that I have to concern myself with just how fast my compression is going. So let's do an ls here. Here's trash git tar z. So I'm going to do an unzip trash.git-tar.lz. And it says that it is, the signature is not found. Either this file is not a zip file or it is a multi-part file and so on. So zip, the actual, you know, the zip command, which I think, we've talked about it before, I'm pretty sure. I think there's some fancy name for it. I don't remember what it's called, though. I think there was some kind of, you know, longer name for the proper zip file. Infozip, that was it. Info-zip. Doesn't recognize an LZIP, apparently, as a zip file. And that makes some sense, because I didn't think Lisma was the same as Infozip. I didn't have any reason to believe. Oh, it's PKZIP is actually what I was thinking of anyway. PKZIP, Phil Katz's zip for MS-DOS. Yeah, who knows? Who knows? Who cares? Zip files, I typically the only reason I ever use zip, literal zip, is because I know that sometimes I'm sending it to someone who's not going to have access to untar. And that really boils down to Windows users, because even Mac users can untar a gzip or bzip file. If memory serves, their GUI can do it for them. They don't even have to think about it. They just double click on it. It gets unarchived. So I thought technically, and this, I'm wrong, but I thought that things like 7-zip, which, or 7-z, whatever, 7-zip does, it implements a Lisma compression algorithm. So I thought, well, okay, then probably LZ will be something that 7-zip could unarchive. And I tried that, 7zx, space x, space, for instance. Let's try it with this one first. mycontainer.conf.lz says that it can't open that as an archive. That's surprising. So then let's just try Lisma directly. So that's Lisma LZMA dash dash decompress mycontainer.conf.lz, file format not recognized. So this is kind of disconcerting to me, because if I'm reading this correctly, and maybe I'm just missing something, but as far as I can tell, LZIP is the only thing that can open LZIP files. And that makes me a little bit nervous. I don't love that. I mean, like, at least, I mean, I realize GZIP and BZIP are kind of, they only, you know, they have their algorithms that they use, and it's different from a lot of other stuff. But then again, I mean, I could do a 7z x on trashy.git.tar.gz, and that unzips fine. So that works. So I've got at least one backup system there. But for LZIP to be the only thing that recognizes an LZIP file, even though it's open source and I should feel fine about that, I'm a little bit hesitant to adopt a tool for which there is only one tool to then undo that compression. So not super confident in that aspect of it. Probably just stick with gzip or bzip myself. It is, what about xz? Let's try xz really quick. I am curious. xz-decompress, although I think this actually comes with the Lisma tool. It's probably not going to work, but let's try it. Yeah, file format. Yeah, LZIP, as far as I can tell, that is the only thing that can decompress an LZIP file. And that does make me a little bit nervous. But anyway, LZIP, it's a compression tool. You could use it if you wanted to. I'm just taking notice that it's apparently the only thing that can decompress itself. Not sure if I'm crazy about that aspect, but it is open source, so it's all out there, and it will be out there for as long as it's out there, so that's a good thing. That's it. Now we're done with the L's in the AP package set. That means next week we can move on to the M section for Mad Play Man and MariaDB and MC and a bunch of other stuff. So join me, won't you, next week. Podcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @Klaatu at mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, newworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time.
Down through the sinuses, slide down the esophagus, and finally let them plunge to the base of the soul itself.